in their view, be the most secure place in the city. But Johnson did not agree. No one had yet given him any definite word on the president's condition. No one had yet made, in that little curtained room, any explicit statement. In Brooks's recollection, he said, "Well, we want to get the official report on that rather than from some individual." He wouldn't leave without permission from the president's staff, he said, preferably from the staff member who was, among the White House staffers in Dallas, the closest to the president, Ken O'Donnell. Youngblood and Roberts continued, in Youngblood's phrase, to press Johnson to leave the hospital immediately. They suggested that he, the vice president, think it over, as he would have to be sworn in. But Johnson didn't change his mind about staying put until there was some definite word on the president. And there was still, for minutes that seemed very long, no definite word. "Every face that came in, you searched for the answers you must know," Lady Bird Johnson was to say. Lyndon Johnson still stood against the wall in that small curtained space, his wife sitting beside him, two or three men off to one side, standing silent or occasionally whispering among themselves. Standing in front of him, always there was roof, Mrs. Johnson says. Johnson stood there for about 35 minutes. Then at 1:20, O'Donnell appeared at the door and crossed the room to Lyndon Johnson, and seeing the stricken face of Kenny O'Donnell, who loved him so much, Lady Bird knew. "He's gone," O'Donnell said, to the 36th President of the United States. When the first calls came into George Hunt's office at Life reporting that Kennedy had been shot, "At first, that's all, just that he had been shot," Russ Sackett recalls. "The meeting broke up immediately, with editors and reporters running back to their offices. While during the next few minutes the news was trickling in from Dallas, one decision was made quickly. Keith Wheeler's proposed second article on Lyndon Johnson would not run in the next issue of the magazine. There was obviously going to be so much other news that there would be no room for it. About a week later, William Lambert went in to see executive editor Ralph Graves and told Graves that any further investigation into Johnson's finances should be postponed. "I told him I thought we ought to give the guy a chance," he said about the president, and Graves agreed, saying, in Lambert's recollection, "If you hadn't said that, I was going to tell you that." No one thought to notify the four men meeting behind closed doors in room 312 of the old Senate office building about what was happening in Dallas. And Don Reynolds continued giving his account and pushing his checks and invoices across the table to Van Kirk and Drennan. According to the most definitive account of the Bobby Baker case, it was shortly after 2:30 Washington time, 1:30 Texas time, about 10 minutes after O'Donnell had told Lyndon Johnson, "He's gone," that Reynolds finished. And just as he did, a secretary burst into the room, sobbing almost hysterically, and shouting that President Kennedy had been killed. Reynolds, saying that since Johnson was now president, "You won't need those," reached for his documents to take them back. But Van Kirk refused to let him take them, saying that they now belonged to the Rules Committee. At the moment the news from Dallas reached Abe Fortas's office, he was conferring with Bobby Baker, who had retained him as his attorney in the Rules Committee investigation and in any criminal prosecutions that might follow. As soon as the news came, Baker recalls, he realized that if Fortas continued to represent him, the attorney might find himself in a conflict of interest situation. Telling Fortas, "I know Lyndon Johnson will be calling on you for advice," he released him as his attorney. Chapter 12. Taking Charge. "He's gone," Ken O'Donnell said. And right then, Homer Thornberry says, he took charge. Even before O'Donnell came in, as Lyndon Johnson had been standing against the back wall of that curtained cubicle in Parkland Hospital, there had been something striking in his bearing, something that had first shown itself that day in the tone of his voice as he lay on the floor of a speeding car, with a heavy body on top of him, and the frantic voices on the shortwave radio crackling in his ears. Johnson's aides and allies knew that for all his rages and bellowing, his gloating and groaning, his endless monologues, his demeanor was very different in moments of crisis, in moments when there were decisions, tough decisions, crucial decisions, to be made, that in those moments he became, as his secretary Mary Rather says, quiet and still. He had been very quiet during the long minutes he stood there in the little room. Very little passed between us, Homer Thornberry says. No words even to Lady Bird. As he stood in front of that blank wall, carnation still in his buttonhole, there was a stillness about him, an immobility, a composure that hadn't been seen very much during the past 3 years. Though he had been for those years restless, unable to sit still, unable to keep his mind on one subject, unable to stop talking, he wasn't restless in that little room. And the hangdog look was gone, replaced with an expression, the lines on the face no longer drooping but hard, that Jack Brooks describes as set. Lyndon Johnson's oldest aides and allies, the men who had known him longest, knew that expression. The big jaw jutting, the lips above it pulled into a tight, grim line, the corners turned down in a hint of a snarl, the eyes, under those long black eyebrows, narrowed, hard, piercing. It was an expression of determination and fierce concentration. When Lyndon Johnson wore that expression, a problem was being thought through with an intensity that was almost palpable. A problem was being thought through, and a decision made. That expression, set and hard, was, Busby says, Lyndon Johnson's deciding expression. And that was his expression now. To Lady Bird Johnson, looking up at her husband, his face had become almost a graven image of a face carved in bronze. What was going through Lyndon Johnson's mind as he stood there, history will never know. The only thing that is clear is that if, during those long minutes of waiting, he was making decisions, this man with the instinct to decide, the will to decide, by the time O'Donnell spoke and the waiting was over, the decisions had been made. O'Donnell and the Secret Service agents were still urging him to leave the hospital and fly back to Washington at once. "We've got to get in the air," Emery Roberts said again. The possibility of conspiracy was looming larger because Johnson now learned, or was reminded, that 6 members of the cabinet, including Secretary of State Rusk and Treasury Secretary Dillon, together with Press Secretary Pierre Salinger, were not in Washington but in a plane en route to a conference in Japan. In fact, they were at that moment somewhere west of Hawaii. Johnson, as one account puts it, was disturbed to learn that half the cabinet was 5 time zones away, somewhere over the vast Pacific Ocean, and all together on the same plane. The Dallas motorcade had been one of the rare occasions when President and Vice President were not only both out of Washington, but both in the same motorcade. With so many other officials away from Washington at the same time and bunched together on the same plane, the shots at the president had been fired at a moment when the government of the United States was unusually vulnerable. Was that fact only a coincidence, or was it the reason the moment had been chosen? The possibility that the shooting was part of a far-ranging conspiracy that had not yet run its course was in the thoughts of everyone, Youngblood recalls. Among the reporters being herded into a nurse's classroom at the other end of Parkland Hospital that was going to be the press briefing room, there was, as Charles Roberts, Newsweek's longtime White House correspondent, recalls, a fear that perhaps a lot of people thought as I did of Lincoln's assassination, where not only Lincoln but 4 or 5 of his cabinet were marked for assassination, that it might be, just might be, an attempt to literally wipe out the entire top echelon of the government. We certainly had no way of knowing it was a lone gunman. The urging from the men standing in front of Johnson intensified. "Sir," Youngblood said, "we must leave here immediately." O'Donnell told him that, in my opinion, he ought to get out of there as fast as he could. "We've got to get in the air," Emery Roberts said. But Johnson reached a different decision, and he announced it as quickly as if he had already thought through all the options and decided what he would do. When O'Donnell kept pressing him to leave Dallas, he asked him, "Well, what about Mrs. Kennedy?" And when O'Donnell said that she was determined not to leave her husband's body, at that moment she was standing, shocked and silent, in a corridor outside the room in which the body was lying, and that Johnson should fly back without her, while she and her husband's body and aides followed in another plane, Johnson said he wasn't going to do that, that he would take her back on the same plane with him. O'Donnell said she would never leave the hospital without the body. Johnson said in that case he would leave the hospital, but not Dallas. He would go to the plane, but he would wait aboard it for the coffin and the widow to arrive. A contrary course continued to be urged. A new adjective entered the descriptions of Lyndon Johnson. He was, Youngblood says, adamant. He wasn't ignoring the conspiracy possibility. In fact, he mentioned the attempt on the life of Secretary of State Seward at the time of Lincoln's assassination, O'Donnell says. Therefore, Johnson said, since they were going to leave the hospital, they should leave immediately. Exchanging quick sentences, he and Youngblood agreed that because of the possibility of another assassination attempt, the trip back to Love Field should be made in as much secrecy as possible. By different hospital corridors from the ones they had run through on the way in different cars from the ones they had arrived in, by a different route from the one the motorcade had taken into the city. Youngblood said that when they started moving, they should move fast, and should use black, unmarked cars, with Johnson and Lady Bird in separate cars, and Johnson told him to have the cars gotten ready, and Youngblood sent an agent to do so, telling him to have the cars waiting with their motors running in the ambulance bays at the emergency room entrance, and to make sure the drivers knew backstreet routes to the airport so they could use them if necessary. Quick plans were made about how to get to the car, who to ride in what, Lady Bird was to say. Her husband, she was to say, was the most decisive person around us. Not that he wasn't willing to listen, but he was quick to decide. A moment later, another decision had to be made. The press secretary on the Texas trip, Salinger's assistant, Malcolm Kilduff, came into the curtained room to ask Johnson's permission to announce Kennedy's death to the press corps that was waiting in the nurse's classroom. "Mr. President," he began. It was the first time that anyone had ever called Lyndon Johnson that. But when he answered Kilduff, it was a president answering, firm and in command. He reacted immediately, Kilduff was to recall, immediately and unequivocally. "No," he said, "don't make that announcement yet. Wait until I get out of here and back to the plane before you announce it. We don't know whether this is a worldwide conspiracy, whether they are after me as well. We just don't know." "And get in touch with that plane carrying the cabinet," he said. "Get that plane turned around." The cabinet plane, notified of the assassination by the White House, had already turned around, but neither Johnson nor anyone in the room with him was aware of that. He made his dispositions. There hadn't been many allies in that motorcade. Three whose loyalty he could count on were the Texas congressmen, and he told the two who were in the room, Homer Thornberry and Jack Brooks, to ride back to the plane with him. He wanted every one of the few aides who had accompanied him to Dallas rounded up. He told Cliff Carter not to leave the hospital with him, but to find Liz Carpenter and Marie Famer and bring them to the plane. That still wasn't much staff. Among the handful of people in his party was a Houston public relations man, Jack Valenti, who had caught Johnson's attention a few years before by writing favorable newspaper columns about him, and who had worked with him on arrangements for the Albert Thomas Appreciation Dinner. He told Carter to find Valenti and bring him. Carter and his crew would need a driver, he told Youngblood, and Youngblood assigned an agent to wait at the ambulance bays until they arrived. Then he was ready. "Homer, you go with me," he said. "Jack, you go with Bird." In a rush, not running because that would call attention to them, but walking as fast as they could, they left the cubicle, through hospital corridors, following a red stripe on the floor to the emergency room exit where the cars were waiting. Youngblood first, his head turning ceaselessly from side to side as he searched for danger, Johnson second, his eyes down as if he didn't want to catch the eye of anyone who might be watching. Then the two congressmen, and then two more Secret Service agents, and Lady Bird, who kept breaking into a trot as she tried to keep up. "Getting out of the hospital was one of the swiftest walks I have ever made," she was to recall. The White House press corps was gathered in the nurse's classroom at the other end of Parkland Hospital, waiting for word on Kennedy's condition. As the new president of the United States headed out of the hospital, Robert Pierpoint of CBS News caught a glimpse of him but didn't follow him. No other reporter followed him or apparently even knew he was leaving. "We weren't thinking about succession," Newsweek's Roberts would explain. "I don't remember anybody saying, 'My God, Johnson is president.'" There was almost no focus of attention on him, and this was true as they left the hospital. Nobody made any attempt to follow him, although he was then president of the United States. One photographer, official White House photographer Captain Cecil Stoughton of the Army Signal Corps, happened to be standing by the emergency room reception desk at the moment the little procession hurried by. Suspecting that Kennedy was dead, he decided to follow and caught a ride a few minutes later with Carter and Valenti. Getting into the back seat of the first car, Johnson sat behind the driver, Youngblood by the window on the other side of the back seat, in the place where the vice president normally sat, so that if someone fired at the person in that seat, thinking it was the vice president, the bullet would hit him instead of Johnson. Thornberry sat in front. Youngblood told Johnson to keep below window level, and he slouched down on his shoulder blades. As they were pulling away from the hospital, another piece of protection was added. Congressman Thomas, standing near the ambulance bays, saw the cars and motioned for them to stop for him. Youngblood told the driver to keep going, but Johnson said, "Stop and let him in." Thompson got in the front seat beside Thornberry. As the car started moving again, Johnson told Thornberry to climb across the back of the front seat and get in the rear. Thornberry did, but did not wind up sitting in the vacant space between Johnson and Youngblood. Instead, Youngblood was to report he took a position on the window side, behind the driver, where Johnson had been sitting. Whether Johnson had changed seats by accident or design, he now had a human shield between him and any bullets on the left side as well as the right. One of the motorcycle policemen in front of them began to sound his siren. "Let's don't have the sirens," Johnson said. As they sped through the Dallas streets, Lady Bird, following in the second car, saw, atop a building, a flag at half-mast. "I think that was when the enormity of what happened first struck me." And then they were on the Love Field tarmac, and Youngblood was to recall, "Suddenly, there before us was one of the most welcome sights I had ever seen. Air Force One." The staircase to the rear door in the presidential quarters was in place, and he and Lyndon Johnson practically ran up the steps. Entering the rear of the plane, Johnson walked forward down a narrow aisle, past a sitting area with six first-class-type plane seats, and then past the small bedroom with beds for the president and his wife. "I want this kept strictly for the use of Mrs. Kennedy, Rufus," Johnson said. "See to that." And into the president's stateroom, a compartment 16 feet square with a small sofa attached to a wall, a small desk with a high-backed armchair for the president, and a small conference table with four chairs. A handful of crew members and White House staff, including two secretaries, were watching the television set. Back at Parkland Hospital, Kilduff had announced Kennedy's death, and Walter Cronkite of CBS was reporting it to the country. Youngblood was shouting to everyone to pull down the window shades. The possibility of a conspiracy and of snipers at the airport still seemed very real indeed, the agent was to say. From the secretaries came the sound of weeping. The stateroom was already warm. Having been alerted to prepare for an immediate takeoff, Air Force One's pilot, Colonel Jim Swindle, had disconnected the air conditioning unit, mounted on a mobile cart that kept the plane cool on the ground. The plane's own air conditioning functioned only when the plane's engines were running. Swindle had only one running, at a low speed that provided electricity for lights in the cabins, but not air conditioning. For a few minutes there was a hurried conference between Johnson and the three Texas congressmen, because there were decisions to be made. When and where to take the oath of office, whether here in Dallas or in Washington, where there could be a formal ceremony in an appropriate setting with the oath administered by Chief Justice Earl Warren, as Warren had administered it to John F. Kennedy at his inauguration. Harry Truman, another vice president brought to the presidency by the sudden death of his predecessor, had not been sworn in for 2 hours and 24 minutes after Franklin D. Roosevelt's death, and almost 2 hours after he had been notified of it. Waiting until the cabinet, congressional leaders, and several other key government officials could be assembled in the cabinet room at the White House to watch Chief Justice Harlan Stone swear him in. Thornberry argued for Washington, Thomas and Brooks for Dallas, so that the country would immediately see that the succession had taken place. "Suppose the plane is delayed," Thomas asked. But a few minutes was all that the discussion lasted. There were reasons for the swearing-in to take place quickly. The fact that the president had been assassinated, and that a wider conspiracy might be involved, made the need to establish a sense of continuity, of stability, more urgent. Should the Russians try to take advantage of the situation, there would not be the slightest doubt about who was in command. A panic on Wall Street that was to wipe out more than $10 billion in stock values within slightly more than an hour was already underway. Although the taking of the oath was a merely symbolic gesture, no one but a vice president had ever ascended to the presidency when a president died, so precedent had established that a vice president became president automatically, immediately upon a president's death. It was a powerful symbol. To Johnson it seemed particularly meaningful, as if, despite the fact that he had actually been president since the moment Kennedy died, it would be the taking of the oath that would truly make him president. Later, discussing November 22nd, he would say, "I took the oath. I became president." During the discussion, a crew member saw that Johnson was very much in command. And as soon as Thomas finished arguing for taking the oath in Dallas, he said, "I agree." If coolness and decisiveness under pressure were components of Lyndon Johnson's character, there were, however, as always with Johnson, other contrasting components. Aware though he was of considerations that militated against anyone entering the presidential bedroom, that it should be kept strictly for the use of Mrs. Kennedy, as he had instructed Youngblood, there now arose another consideration. He had telephone calls to make, including one of a particularly delicate nature, and he wanted privacy while he made them. Privacy was available in the stateroom where he was standing. As it happens, he was standing right beside a telephone. Doors on either side of the room could close it off completely from the rest of the plane. He could have asked the people in the room to leave and closed the doors. But he had more privacy in mind than that. Leading Marie Famer and Youngblood, who said he would not leave his side until the plane was in the air, into the Kennedys' bedroom, he closed the door, pulled off the jacket of his suit, and sat down, sprawling down, on one of the beds. And these other components were demonstrated also by the identity of the person to whom the delicate phone call was made, and by the questions Lyndon Johnson asked during the call. Objective, rational reasons can explain why Lyndon Johnson called Robert Kennedy. One of the purposes of the call was to obtain a legal opinion on a matter of governmental policy, and Kennedy was the country's chief legal officer. And the decision to take the oath having been made, the wording of the oath was needed. And there was also the question of who was legally empowered to administer it, and these pieces of information could be obtained most authoritatively from the same source. And there were strategic reasons for him to have called Bobby. Lyndon Johnson seems to have had, even in this first hour after John F. Kennedy's death, feelings that would torment him for the rest of his life. Feelings understandable in any man placed in the presidency not through an election but through an assassin's bullet, and feelings exacerbated in his case by the contrast, and what he felt was the world's view of the contrast, between him and the president he was replacing, by the contempt in which he had been held by the people around the president, and by the stark geographical fact of the location of the act that had elevated him to office. Recalling his feelings years later in his retirement, he would say that even after he had taken the oath, "For millions of Americans I was still illegitimate, a naked man with no presidential covering, a pretender to the throne, an illegal usurper. And then there was Texas, my home, the home of the murder. And then there were the bigots and the dividers and the Eastern intellectuals who were waiting to knock me down before I could even begin to stand up." He seems to have felt, even in this first hour, that the best way to legitimize his ascent to the throne, to make himself seem less like a usurper, would be to demonstrate that his ascent had the support of his predecessor's family. The decision to be sworn in immediately in Dallas, instead of waiting until he returned to Washington, had been made, but he wanted that decision to be approved by the man whose approval would carry the most weight. There were, of course, reasons for him not to have called Robert Kennedy, reasons for him to have obtained the information he wanted from someone else, from anyone else. The questions he asked on the call, whether the swearing-in could take place in Dallas, what was the wording of the oath, who could administer it, were not complicated questions and could have been answered by any one of 100 government officials. One of them, in fact, was an official he had already dealt with extensively on questions of vice presidential procedure, on the drafting of the executive order establishing the Committee on Equal Opportunity, for example, and whom he trusted and even felt a rapport with, the number two man in the Justice Department, Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach. And there were other non-governmental considerations that might have led him to telephone Katzenbach or some other official rather than the one he called, considerations of humanity rather than of politics. But none of these more personal considerations appear to have had much weight with him, unless perhaps they did. Whatever the reasons, a half hour after Robert Kennedy had been told that the brother he loved so deeply was dead, the telephone rang again at Hickory Hill, and when Kennedy picked it up, he found himself talking to the man he hated so deeply, who was asking him to provide details of the precise procedure by which he could, without delay, assume his brother's office. Robert Kennedy had been having lunch with Ethel, United States Attorney Robert Morgenthau of New York, and Morgenthau's deputy Silvio Malo by the side of the swimming pool at Hickory Hill. It was a bright, sunny day, warm for November. At the top of the lawn sloping up from the pool, workmen were painting a new wing that had been added to the rambling white house. Suddenly, Morgenthau saw one of the workmen start running toward them. He was holding a transistor radio in his hand, and he was shouting something that no one understood. Just then a telephone rang on the other side of the pool, and Ethel walked around the pool to answer it and said it was J. Edgar Hoover, and Bobby walked over to take the call, and Morgenthau saw him clap his hand to his mouth and turn away with a look of shock and horror on his face. "Jack's been shot," he said. "It may be fatal." He walked back to the house and tried to get more news, and a few minutes later, at 2:25, according to White House phone logs, he got it from a White House aide, and a few minutes after that it was confirmed by Hoover, and then, at 2:56, Lyndon Johnson was on the phone. This call, and a second one between Johnson and Robert Kennedy 6 minutes later, was not recorded, and, as had been the case with the meetings of the two men in Los Angeles 3 years before, their recollections differ. The only witnesses to the calls, Rufus Youngblood and Marie Famer, heard only one side of them, and their impressions of what occurred differ markedly from those of Katzenbach, to whom Robert Kennedy spoke both between the two calls and immediately afterwards. But whatever the differences, there emerges from the recollections and impressions a picture of two conversations between a man who knew exactly what he wanted and what to say in order to get it, and a man so stunned by grief and shock that he hardly knew what he was saying, or even to some extent, what he was hearing. Johnson would give accounts of the telephone calls several times, both in the months immediately following the assassination, and in 1967, when the dispute over the conversations grew so public and bitter that it, along with the dispute over his Los Angeles meetings with Robert Kennedy, not only became a crucial element in this great blood feud, perhaps the greatest blood feud of American politics in the 20th century, but also one that played a role, small but not insignificant, in decisions that shaped the course of American history. By his account, he telephoned Kennedy because "I wanted to say something to comfort him in his grief." And by Johnson's account, he succeeded in this purpose, bringing Kennedy's mind around to practical matters. "In spite of his shock and sorrow," Johnson said, "Kennedy discussed the practical problems at hand with dispatch. He was very businesslike. They discussed the matter of my taking the oath of office and the possibility of a conspiracy," Johnson was to say. "Kennedy," he says, "said that he would like to look into the matter of when and where the oath should be administered and call back. And when Kennedy called back, he said that the oath should be administered to me immediately." Kennedy's accounts of the conversations, including one he gave that evening to Ken O'Donnell after O'Donnell had arrived back in Washington, were different. Johnson had, Bobby said, told him that a lot of people down here had advised him to be sworn in right away, and asked if he had any objections. When there was no immediate reply, Johnson pressed him, asking, "Do you have any objections to that?" Bobby said he hadn't replied to the question. "I was too surprised to say anything about it. I said to myself, what's the rush? Couldn't he wait until he got the president's body out of there and back to Washington?" Johnson, in this account, took, or used, silence as assent. "He began to ask me a lot of questions about who should swear him in. I was too confused and upset to talk to him about it." In a later conversation Bobby taped for posterity, He said he had never told Johnson that the oath should be administered immediately. I was sort of taken aback at the moment because I didn't think, see what the rush was. In fact, he says his wishes were the opposite of what Johnson portrayed them to be. I thought, I suppose at the time at least, I thought it would be nice if the president came back to Washington as President Kennedy. The only aspect of the conversation that is agreed on was that Kennedy said he would look into the matter and call Johnson back. Kennedy called Katzenbach, who recalls him saying, "They want to swear him in right away in Texas. That's not necessary, is it?" "No, not necessary," Katzenbach replied. And when Kennedy asked who could swear him in, Katzenbach said, "Anyone who can administer an oath," a category that included any federal judge or hundreds of other federal officials. The place or exact time of the swearing-in didn't matter. You become president when the president dies. That's accepted. It's not a question. Katzenbach was to say he agreed that an immediate swearing-in, while not necessary, was desirable, given its symbolic significance. But, he told the author, he was absolutely stunned that Johnson had made the call to Bobby Kennedy so soon after his brother's death. So many federal officials could have given Johnson the information he was seeking, he says. He could have called me. I was in my office. He felt Johnson might have made the call because he may have wanted to be absolutely sure that there wouldn't be an explosion from Bobby's end. Wanted to ensure that Bobby would not later say that the immediate swearing-in showed a lack of respect for the dead president. But, he says, given Bobby's feelings about Johnson and about his brother, the fact that Johnson had called Bobby so soon after his brother's death frankly appalled him. Calling Bobby was really wrong. Then there was a second call, the return call from Robert Kennedy to Lyndon Johnson, about which, as William Manchester writes, "The facts are unclear and a dispassionate observer cannot choose." Johnson was to say that on this call Kennedy advised him that the oath should be administered to me immediately before taking off for Washington, and that it could be administered by any judicial officer. During the call, however, it became clear that the questions of when and where the oath should be administered were in fact now moot, and that all Johnson wanted from Kennedy was the oath's precise wording. Kennedy said he would have Katzenbach dictate it. Telephoning his deputy again, he said, "They're going to swear him in down there, and he needs the oath." Katzenbach pulled a copy of the Constitution off his bookshelf and read the 37-word declaration that is in Article 2, Section 1. "I do solemnly swear, or affirm, that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." Johnson had told Marie Famer to go out to the staff section of the plane and take down the wording. "Bobby started it and turned the phone to Katzenbach," she recalls. Katzenbach apparently patched into this second call. "What was Katzenbach's voice like at that time?" she has asked. "It was controlled. He was like steel," she replies. "Bobby's was not when he started. I kept thinking, you shouldn't be doing this." When Katzenbach finished, she says, she asked him, "May I read it back to you?" Which I afterward thought may have been a little cruel, but yet I wanted to check it. As for her own emotional state at the time, she says, "I was all right. I broke up later that night, but I was all right." You get that feeling from him, Johnson. He taught you that, by George, you can do anything. There was a job to be done. Whatever the disputes over the telephone calls, the oath was dictated and typed out, and if the desire to send by Bobby Kennedy to its immediate administration was not obtained, at least he had been asked whether he objected to that, and had not replied, so it would be difficult for him to criticize it later. The possibility of public criticism from the president's brother had been muted, as it would turn out only for a time. The call to Hickory Hill had achieved its purpose. Whatever the details of the conversation between Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy, when Johnson hung up the phone, he had gotten enough of what he wanted so that he could go ahead. Hanging up the phone, he began giving orders. Any federal judge could swear him in, he had been told. He knew what judge he wanted, and she was right in Dallas. As much as any single person possibly could, an historian has written, this judge had personified Johnson's utter powerlessness during his vice presidency. He had been unable to secure her appointment. She had been named to the Federal District Court in Dallas only after Sam Rayburn had intervened, a fact which had made Johnson feel like the biggest liar and fool in the state. "Get Sarah Hughes," he told Marie Famer. Judge Hughes's law clerk told Miss Famer he didn't know the judge's whereabouts. The last he knew, he said, she had been at the trademark luncheon waiting for the president to arrive, and Famer told Johnson that. He told her to call the clerk back and picked up the receiver himself. "This is Lyndon Johnson," he said. "Find her." She was found, and she hurried to Love Field. He wanted something more from the Kennedys, and he got that too. No single gesture would do more to demonstrate continuity and stability, to show that the government of the United States would continue to function without interruption, despite the assassination of the man who sat at its head, and to legitimize the transition, to prove that the transfer of power had been orderly, proper, in accordance with the Constitution, to remove in the eyes of the world any taint of usurpation, to dampen so far as possible suspicion of complicity by him in the deed, to show that the family of the man he was succeeding bore him no ill will and supported him, than the attendance at his swearing-in ceremony of the late president's widow. Was this consideration part of the reason, in addition to the humanitarian consideration, that he didn't want her left behind in Dallas? That when the Secret Service and Ken O'Donnell had told him that Jacqueline Kennedy would follow in another plane, he had refused to leave Dallas without her? Certainly some of the Kennedy loyalists harbored that suspicion. Some of us did feel that he was using Mrs. Kennedy and the Kennedy aura when he staged his oath-taking ceremony with her present, and so he could arrive in Washington with her and President Kennedy's casket, O'Donnell was to write. History will never know the answer to that question. All history can know for certain is that now, on Air Force One, he moved with determination to obtain her presence. His efforts were almost derailed at their very start by a moment of awkwardness. While he was making phone calls, not only to Bobby Kennedy but to Walter Jenkins and McGeorge Bundy in the plane's bedroom, hammering began on the other side of the bulkhead that separated the bedroom from the rear seating compartment. And when Famer went out into the corridor and asked what it was, crew members told her that four of the six seats in the compartment were being removed to make room for Kennedy's heavy bronze coffin, which was about to be brought on board through the plane's rear door, followed by Jackie and Kennedy's aides. Kennedy's aides were to say later that they weren't aware at that moment that Johnson and his party were aboard the plane, that they had assumed that he had returned to Air Force Two, and in fact had already taken off for Washington. In the confusion, they hadn't noticed that Air Force Two was still parked nearby. As soon as the Kennedy party was on board, while the coffin was being lashed to the floor, Jackie, seeking a few moments alone, walked past it and opened the door to the bedroom, thinking it would be empty, and instead encountered Lyndon Johnson. Whether, when she opened the door, Johnson was, as Manchester wrote after talking to her, reclining on the bed in his shirt sleeves, or whether, as Famer later stated, in an effort to clear up the bedroom thing. He had already risen from the bed and was about to leave the bedroom when, as he opened the door, there was Mrs. Kennedy. She was evidently shocked. Hastily retreating to the rear compartment, she told O'Donnell. He relates, "Something that left me stunned. When she opened the door of her cabin, she found Lyndon Johnson." She wasn't the only one who retreated. "She was entering her private bedroom," Famer says. "She saw a stranger, in his shirt sleeves yet, in the hallowed ground. We, of course, scurried out of that bedroom. It was really embarrassing." Returning to the rear compartment, Jackie sat down in one of the two remaining seats across the aisle from the coffin. In a moment, Lyndon, having collected Lady Bird from the stateroom, came back to see her. "It was a very, very hard thing to do," Lady Bird Johnson was to recall. "Mrs. Kennedy's dress was stained with blood. One leg was almost entirely covered with it, and her right glove was caked. That immaculate woman, it was caked with blood, her husband's blood. She always wore gloves like she was used to them. I never could. Somehow that was one of the most poignant sights. Mrs. Kennedy exquisitely dressed and caked in blood." Shocked though she was at Jackie's appearance, Lady Bird found the right things to say. "Dear God, it's come to this," and Jackie responded, making it as easy as possible. She said things like, "Oh, Lady Bird, we've always liked the two of you so much." She said, "Oh, what if I had not been there? Oh, I'm so glad I was there." Only once did Jackie's voice change, when Lady Bird asked her if she wanted to change clothes. "Not right then," Jackie said. And then, if with a person that gentle, that dignified, you can say had an element of fierceness, she said, "I want them to see what they have done to Jack." And Lyndon finally raised the subject. "Well, about the swearing in," he said. According to Manchester, he had to use the phrase twice before Jackie responded, "Oh yes, I know, I know." She understood the symbols of authority, the need for some semblance of national majesty after the disaster, Manchester was to write. Whether she agreed explicitly or not, there was an understanding that when Johnson took the oath, she would be present. And with his work with the Kennedys done, Lyndon Johnson headed back to the stateroom. It was crammed now with people, Secret Service agents, the three Texas congressmen, Kennedy's aides and secretaries who had come aboard with the coffin, two uniformed generals, Kennedy's military aides Clifton and Brigadier General Godfrey McHugh, Johnson aides Carter, Valenti, Famer, Liz Carpenter, Bill Moyers, who, hearing of the assassination while in Austin on a trip for the Peace Corps, had chartered a plane, flown to Dallas, and come aboard Air Force One, two presidential valets, Kennedy's Thomas and Johnson's Glynn, all crowded together in a 16-by-16-foot square that was so dimly lit, with the shades still drawn across the windows, the only lighting came from the dim fluorescent bulbs overhead, that the general's gold braid glinted only faintly in the gloom, and that with no air conditioning had grown so hot and stuffy that, one man says, it was suffocating in there, it was hard to think. The low, penetrating whine of the single jet engine that was operating never stopped. There was weeping in the room, and whispering, and confusion. Kennedy's aides had been able to remove the dead president's coffin from the hospital only after an angry confrontation with the Dallas County medical examiner, who, insisting that an autopsy had to be performed first, had stood in a hospital doorway to block them, backed by a policeman. They had literally shoved the examiner and the policeman aside to get out of the building, and now on the plane, O'Donnell says, he kept looking out the window, expecting to see the flashing red lights of police cars, coming with a court order to stop our takeoff. Not knowing when they came aboard that Johnson had decided to wait for Judge Hughes and take the oath on the ground, not knowing for some minutes, in fact, that Johnson was even on board, he was at that time behind the closed door of Kennedy's bedroom. General McHugh had gone forward to the cockpit and ordered Colonel Swindle to take off immediately. Swindle couldn't. The plane's forward door was still open, with the ramp still pushed up against it. And by the time the door was closed, Malcolm Kilduff had come to the cockpit to tell them that the plane wouldn't be taking off until after the swearing-in ceremony. When McHugh, who had apparently passed Kilduff in the aisle without knowing what message the press secretary was bearing, realized the plane wasn't taking off, he rushed back to the cockpit to repeat his order, and Kilduff countermanded it. Not until O'Donnell, in a highly desperate strait, he says, headed for the cockpit himself, did he learn of Johnson's plans. The conflicting orders were less the bitter series of confrontations between Kennedy and Johnson aides that would later be pictured than a misunderstanding, but they added to the confusion. McHugh and other Kennedy aides were still pushing back and forth down the crowded aisle in the passenger portion of the plane, and in the stateroom men and women were asking each other what was happening, what was going to happen, without anyone really knowing. And then, in the narrow doorway that led back toward the presidential bedroom, there suddenly appeared, in Jack Valenti's words, the huge figure of Lyndon Johnson. The carnation was gone. The dark gray of his suit, which appeared black in the dim light, was relieved only by the tiny silver star bar in his lapel, and a corner of a white handkerchief peeking out from the breast pocket. His thinning hair was slicked down smooth, so that as his head turned from side to side, as he surveyed the cabin, checking on who was there, there was nothing to soften that massive skull, or the sharp jut of the big jaw and the big nose, and his mouth was set in that grim, tough line. Seeing him standing there, Valenti, whose acquaintance with Lyndon Johnson had taken place mainly during his vice presidency, was startled. Even in that instant, there was a new demeanor in him, he was to say. He looked graver. The restless movements were gone. Whatever emotions or passions he had in him, he had put them under a strict discipline, so that he was very quiet and seemingly very much in command of himself. There had, Valenti says, been a transformation. He was, in a strange way, another man, not the man I had known. Other Johnson aides who had known him longer saw, after he had returned to Washington that night, the same transformation, but found nothing strange in it. The Lyndon Johnson that Horace Busby saw in Washington that night was a Lyndon Johnson he hadn't seen for 3 years, but it was a Lyndon Johnson he remembered very well. The Johnson he saw, and that George Reedy and Walter Jenkins and other longtime aides saw, was simply the old Lyndon Johnson, the pre-vice presidential Lyndon Johnson. And Busby understood why he had changed back, and why he had been able to change back so quickly. You see, it was just that he was coming back to himself, he says. He was back where he belonged. He was back in command. And as the people in the stateroom noticed Johnson standing in the doorway, the ones who had been sitting rose to their feet. The whispering stopped, even, for a moment, the weeping. "When I walked in, everyone stood up," Johnson would write in his memoirs. "Here were close friends like Homer Thornberry and Jack Brooks. Here were aides. All of them were on their feet. I realized nothing would ever be the same again. To old friends who had never called me anything but Lyndon, I would now be Mr. President." In the memoir, he says that this was a frightening, disturbing prospect, but if it was, he gave no sign of that at the time. In the silence, Congressman Thomas said, "We are ready to carry out any orders you have, Mr. President." Walking into the stateroom as the people made way before him, he sat down in the high-backed president's chair. Beckoning Kilduff over, he told him to make sure a photographer and reporters were aboard to record the swearing-in ceremony. "Put the pool on board," he told him. He beckoned over Valenti. "I want you on my staff," he said. "You'll fly back with me to Washington." And when an order was challenged, no challenge was entertained. When O'Donnell and O'Brien came up to him and asked if the plane could take off immediately, he said, "We can't leave here until we take the oath of office. I just talked on the phone with Bobby. He told me to wait here until Sarah Hughes gives me the oath." Then he added a line with connotations. "You must remember Sarah Hughes," he said. O'Donnell didn't believe him. "I could not imagine Bobby telling him to stay. Johnson had become president the moment Kennedy died. The oath is just a symbolic formality. There is no need to hurry about it." And later that night at Hickory Hill, his skepticism would be confirmed. Bobby gave me an entirely different version of his conversation with Johnson. Whether O'Donnell believed him or not no longer signified, however. Johnson's expression hardly changed as he spoke. His voice was so low that, one observer says, he was almost whispering. But if the voice was soft, that was not the case with the message. Johnson was adamant that the oath be administered by Judge Hughes, Larry O'Brien was to say. There was adamancy. It became clear that the oath was going to be administered on the ground. General McHugh was still pushing up and down the aisle, trying to get the plane to take off, not having talked to Johnson directly, but O'Brien and O'Donnell stopped arguing. Standing up, Johnson moved to the center of the crowded little room. He was, as was the case in most rooms he was in, the tallest person in it. And through the recollections of people present in that room, there runs a common theme, a sense that, out of aimless confusion, order was quickly emerging. If one reason for his insistence that the swearing-in take place at the earliest possible moment was to demonstrate, quickly, continuity and stability to the nation and the world, then it was important that the nation and the world see that a new president had taken office. Luckily, White House photographer Cecil Stoughton had come aboard, and almost as soon as Johnson had told Malcolm Kilduff to make sure a photographer was present at the ceremony, Kilduff bumped into him in the aisle. "Thank God you're here," Kilduff said. "The president's going to take the oath." And when Stoughton, carrying two cameras, entered the stateroom, seeing Johnson in there standing tall, Johnson asked him, "Where do you want us, Cecil?" Stoughton told him that the room was so small that he would have to place his own back against a wall, and, to gain height for a better view, stand on the sofa, and that Johnson and the judge should be directly in front of him, but back a few feet. Johnson began moving people around, directing them to their places with jerks of his thumb, taking command, in Stoughton's words. Witnesses were important. Kilduff asked Johnson whom he wanted present. "As many people as you can get in here," he replied. "Witnesses whose presence, whose photographed presence, would be testimony of continuity and legitimacy, of the Kennedy faction's sanction of his assumption of Kennedy's office, were particularly desirable. Two of Jackie's secretaries, Mary Gallagher and Pamela Turner, were in the forward cabin, crying, and he dispatched Kilduff to get them, and they came in, and so did General Clifton. And he wanted from the Kennedy people another more durable demonstration of continuity. Judge Hughes had not yet arrived. There were a few minutes to spare. He used them. Sitting down again, he changed both his chair to one at the conference table. The fact that he was not in the president's chair in itself did not go unnoticed by the two men he beckoned over to sit with him, and his tone, in a change so abrupt and dramatic that it would have been startling to anyone who had not witnessed over the years Lyndon Johnson's remarkable ability to alter tone completely and instantaneously to accomplish a purpose. Where just a few minutes before, in his conversations with O'Donnell and O'Brien, there had been adamancy in full measure, now, in a new conversation with the same two men, there was humility, and in the same measure. He wanted them to remain in their White House posts, he told the two Irishmen, still in the first throes of grief for their dead leader, because the best tribute that could be paid to President Kennedy would be passage of the programs he had believed in. They and he should fight for them together, he said, shoulder to shoulder. And, he said, leaning across the table toward them and looking into their eyes, they should stay on because he needed them. He had so much to learn about his new responsibilities, he said, and he just didn't absorb things as quickly as Jack had. Jack had had not only the experience but the education and understanding. He didn't. I need your help, he said. I need it badly. There is no one for me to turn to with as much experience as you have. I need you now more than President Kennedy needed you. He only had a few minutes to make the plea. Hardly had he finished when Judge Hughes arrived. But although O'Donnell and O'Brien made no response at the time, we can talk about all that later, O'Brien said. O'Donnell was to describe himself as noncommittal. Events were to prove that his plea had softened their feelings toward him. Judge Hughes arrived, a tiny woman in a brown dress decorated with white polka dots, and Johnson showed her to the place Stoughton had selected, in front of the sofa on which the photographer was standing, and someone put a small Catholic missal in her hands. Then, a moment later, three reporters, Newsweek's Roberts, Merriman Smith of UPI, and Sid Davis of Westinghouse Broadcasting, came on board after a wild trip to Love Field in a police car, with the uniformed officer who was driving them speeding through red lights, avoiding tie-ups by bumping over median strips and driving against oncoming traffic. Despite their pleas, the driver had refused to notify their editors of their whereabouts, telling them, Davis recalls, that radio silence had to be maintained because they don't know whether there is a conspiracy or not. We were speculating on, are they going to try for Johnson, and where have they taken him? Are the Russians trying to take over Berlin? Roberts says. Seeing them enter the stateroom, Johnson said, we've got the press here so we can go ahead. He made his final arrangements. Crowded though the stateroom was, a few more witnesses could still be crammed in. Raising his voice so that he could be heard in the forward cabin, he said, now we're going to have a swearing in here, and I would like anyone who wants to see it to come on into this compartment. And Judge Hughes says, in they came until there wasn't another inch of space, until 27 people were wedged into the stateroom, among the desk and the table and the chairs. The Kennedy presence was still not all he wanted it to be. Johnson particularly wanted Evelyn Lincoln, Judge Hughes was to recall. But when she came, she stood in the midst of the crowd behind him, so that she was not sufficiently prominent. He made a gesture, and she squeezed forward until she was standing directly behind him. He made sure his position in front of the judge was precisely where Stoughton wanted him, and placed Lady Bird on his right. He had Kilduff, who had obtained a dictaphone machine, kneel on the floor next to the judge to record the ceremony. One witness was still missing, the most important one. He told Judge Hughes that, as the judge recalls his words, "Mrs. Kennedy wanted to be present and we would wait for her." "Do you want to ask Mrs. Kennedy if she would like to stand with us?" he asked O'Donnell and O'Brien. When they didn't respond at once, the glance he threw at them was the old Johnson glance, the eyes burning with impatience and anger. "She said she wants to be here when I take the oath," he told O'Donnell. "Why don't you see what's keeping her?" The scene was still eerie, the gloom, the heat, the whispering, the low insistent whine of the jet engine, the mass of dim faces crowded so close together. But one element had vanished, the confusion. Watching Lyndon Johnson arrange the crowd, give his orders, deal with O'Donnell and O'Brien, Liz Carpenter, dazed by the rush of events, realized that there was at least one person in the room who wasn't dazed, who was, however hectic the situation might be, in complete command of it. "Your mind was so dull, but one of the thoughts that went through my mind was, someone is in charge. You had the feeling that things were well in hand." Carpenter, like Valenti, was an idolater, but the journalists had the same feeling. On the ride out to the airport, Sid Davis, who, as he recalls, had not known this man except as majority leader and as someone who was thought of by some as Colonel Cornpone, had said to his colleagues in the car, "It's going to be hard to learn how to say President Lyndon B. Johnson." As Davis watched Johnson in the stateroom now, it was, suddenly, no longer hard at all. Soon, immediately, we started to see the measure of the guy and his leadership qualities. Part of the feeling stemmed from his size. As he stood in front of Judge Hughes, towering over everyone in the room, Stoughton realized for the first time how big he was. Big, big. He loomed over everyone. But part of it was something harder to define. As Lyndon Johnson arranged the crowd, jerking his thumb to show people where he wanted them, glancing around with those piercing dark eyes, Valenti's initial feeling that this was a different man was intensified. Johnson was suddenly something larger, harder to fathom, than the man he had thought he knew. He looked, in fact, for the first time in 3 years, like the Lyndon Johnson of the Senate floor. Now he had suddenly come to the very pinnacle of power. However he had gotten there, whatever concatenation of circumstance and tragedy, whatever fate had put him there, he was there, and he knew what to do there. When O'Donnell, obeying his order, went to her bedroom and asked Jacqueline Kennedy if she wanted to be present at the swearing-in, she said, "I think I ought to be there. In the light of history, it would be better if I was there," and followed O'Donnell out to the door of the stateroom. "A hush, a hush. Every whisper stopped," Roberts recalls. She was still wearing the same suit with the same bloodstains. Her eyes were cast down, in Judge Hughes's phrase. She had apparently tried to comb her hair, but it fell down across the left side of her face. On her face was a glazed look, and she appeared to be crying, although no tears were coming out. Johnson placed her on his left side and nodded to the judge, who held out the missal. He put his left hand on it. The hand, mottled and veined, was so large that it all but covered the little book, and raised his right hand as the judge said, "I do solemnly swear." Valenti, watching those hands, saw that they were absolutely steady, and Lyndon Johnson's voice was steady too, low and firm, as he spoke the words he had been waiting to speak all his life. In the back of the room, crowded against a wall, Marie Famer wasn't watching the ceremony because she was reading the oath to make sure it was given correctly. "He taught you that, by George, you can do anything." The oath was over. His hand came down. "Now let's get airborne," Lyndon Johnson said. Part 4. Taking Command. Chapter 13. Aboard Air Force One. The death of a president, with the necessity for the sudden transfer of his enormous powers, is in many ways a supreme test for a democratic government. For what if the transfer did not go smoothly? What if policies were changed? Foreign policies? What if a détente was ended, new orders given, What if along a border, the border between East and West Berlin, perhaps, tensions rose? What if tanks began to rumble forward, troops began to march? What if, in the harbors of naval bases, anchor chains began to rattle aboard so that fleets could sail? Or domestic policies? What if interest rates set by a government agency of which people had previously been only vaguely aware suddenly began to be raised, and raised too high? What if, as a result of that change, businesses that had planned to borrow money to expand suddenly found the cost of money too high and had to contract instead, laying off employees? What if the rates were lowered and lowered too far, and as a result inflation rose and rose too far? What if currencies crumbled, life savings were eaten away, elderly couples suddenly facing impoverished old age? What if tax policies or depreciation allowances were changed so that corporations abruptly found that expansions planned under the old policies would now be unfeasible, so they could no longer afford to add employees? What if previously announced government appropriations were suddenly rescinded, or the schedule of their payments stretched out, so that schools, hospitals, clinics, daycare centers suddenly had bad news for students and patients? What if decisions were made not to build dams or roads on which people had been counting for employment? What if naval yards, aircraft factories were closed, their thousands of employees thrown out of work? What if adjustments were made in government healthcare policies so that families that had been struck by illness but had believed that at least their medical expenses were covered found all at once that in fact they weren't? And beyond institutions and policies, what of the man, the new president? The old president had been elected to that office, installed in it by the will of the people, by the hard concrete totals of the ballots they cast. His place, his authority, legitimated in the word used by Richard Neustadt, perhaps the era's leading analyst of the presidency, by a national election after national campaigning. The people he was governing had given him the authority, legal and moral, to govern them. Although his successor was of course entitled under the Constitution to the office to which he was succeeding, and the electorate was of course aware when it voted for the ticket of which he was a part, that he would occupy that office should the president die, the possibility of the president doing so had not been prominent in its mind. It never is. Voters focus on the candidate at the head of the ticket, not on his running mate. And they focus on the candidate, not on what would happen should the candidate, having been elected, suddenly die. The draping over a vice president of the mantle of authority that had been conferred on the president is not guaranteed to be straightforward. For what if, because of the new president's early actions in his new office, the people found that they did not have confidence in him? What if they felt that the government had abruptly altered course to a wrong course? Or that the firm hand at the helm of state was not a firm hand, and that therefore the circumstances of their own lives, dependent in so many ways, they suddenly realized, now that the president's death had made them think of it, on presidential performance, were suddenly more uncertain than before? If there was no confidence in the continuity and stability of the new government, no feeling that despite a president's death, someone competent was in charge, what then might be the consequences for a democracy? In America, the test is made easier to pass because under the Constitution, the transfer of power is swift and unquestioned. 7 of the nation's 35 presidents had died in office before John F. Kennedy died. In each case, presidential power had been passed to the vice president in a smooth and systematic manner, even in the case of the two deaths that had come at particularly crucial moments of history, Lincoln's and Franklin Roosevelt's, both of which presidencies had ended as the great wars they had directed were ending, with post-war decisions immediately ahead. Roosevelt's death just 18 years before Kennedy's had elevated to the place FDR had filled so long that many Americans could hardly envision anyone else holding it, a man largely unknown to America, and seemingly very ill-fitted for the office, yet the transfer had been instantaneous and smooth. Aspects of the transfer of power which made such transfers fraught with uncertainty and danger in other nations had barely even been thought of, if indeed they were thought of at all. As one political scientist was to put it, the questions that were not raised at the time of Roosevelt's sudden death, and that were not raised at the time of other presidential deaths either, illustrate how fundamental and implicit is the commitment to America's governmental institutions. It is, for example, not so much that the American military did not attempt to take control of the government, it is that no one even thought to ask where the military's support lay. Harry Truman, raising his hand in 1945 to take the oath as Roosevelt's successor before a group of officials in the cabinet room of the White House, realized that although we were in the midst of a great war, only two uniforms were present, and, noting that this passed unnoticed by anyone but him, understood the significance of that fact. The very fact that no thought was given to it demonstrates how firmly the concept of the civil authority was accepted in our land, he wrote. Yet in certain crucial aspects, Lyndon Johnson's ascension to the presidency, the presidential transition of 1963, took place in uncharted waters, in circumstances that made it different from, and in some respects significantly more difficult than, any of the seven previous transitions, even the one that had followed the death of Franklin Roosevelt. Two of these circumstances were products of the age in which this transition occurred, for 1963, unlike 1945, was the age of television and of nuclear weapons. Roosevelt's death, the death of this president who had become a father figure to much of America, was a shock and resulted in immense grief and anxiety. Would, for example, the war drag on longer now that the great leader was dead? Nevertheless, his death, of a stroke after years of failing health that had become increasingly apparent, was a natural death. As one writer put it, violence was missing from the story of Roosevelt's demise. As it must to all men, death came to him. And there was, in effect, no television. Only a few thousand American families had a set. FDR's funeral ceremonies in Washington and at Hyde Park were moving, but while the radio let America listen to them, America couldn't watch them while they were taking place, could see them only in still newspaper photographs and newsreels after the fact. John F. Kennedy's death was unnatural, terrible, violence, murder, blood, and mystery. As Air Force One was flying back to Washington, commentators were speculating, and America was wondering, murder by whom and at whose orders? 40 minutes into the flight, it was announced that a Dallas policeman had been shot, and a few minutes later, that a 24-year-old man, Lee Harvey Oswald, had been arrested in connection with that slaying, and that he also is being questioned to see if he had any connection with Kennedy's assassination. And then, an hour later, that he was a definite suspect in the assassination. And then there were rumors that he had not been the only gunman. And Kennedy's death was made more terrible because of television. Television had, during the almost 3 years of his presidency, brought JFK and his wife and children into America's homes. The first detailed study of America's reaction to the assassination found that 4 out of 5 of those surveyed, 79%, felt with the very deepest feeling, or quite deeply, that not just a president, but someone very close and dear to them, almost like a member of their own family, had died when JFK died. And television intensified the shock and horror, the unnaturalness, of the death of a president who had been the epitome of youth and promise by the rapidity with which it broke the news, the report of the assassination crossing the country, Newsweek said, like a shockwave. By the time Air Force One touched down in Washington, 92% of the American people had heard the news. Television, almost instantaneously, it seemed, bound an entire nation together in a communion of disbelief, sorrow, and anger. And 2 days later, the shock would be multiplied by television, for on that day, the murderer was murdered on live television. The shot fired and Oswald's face contorting in pain as the nation watched. And more questions were raised about what had really happened at Dealey Plaza and why it had happened. During the day of the assassination and the next 3 days, furthermore, the nation would be bound together by television not only in shock, but in mourning. From shortly after the shots in Dallas on Friday to the conclusion of the funeral services in Arlington National Cemetery on Monday, America's 3 television networks canceled all regular programs and all advertising, and carried only news related to the assassination and the events that followed. in coverage uninterrupted by commercials. As the day of the assassination and the 3 days of memorial pageantry for John Fitzgerald Kennedy unfolded in Washington, America sat before its television sets watching it as if the country was gathered in one vast living room, a nation that was, for those 4 days, a single audience in a way that had never happened before in history. A survey by the A.C. Nielsen Company, the leading commercial firm conducting television surveys,